Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Call it Mission Incredible. Saturday night, after a 300-million-mile, 7-month journey, the robot explorer named Spirit landed on Mars. Within hours, it was beaming back black and white images from the red planet. Today, NASA released a 3D panorama and the first color picture from Mars in nearly 7 years. At today's press conference, the emotions of NASA's scientists were over the moon.
We're like kids at the candy store. We're no longer looking in the glass. We're at the case trying to decide which way to go. And we can hardly wait till we get off the lander so we can start driving and doing fun stuff on the surface.
Scientists have big hopes for Mars, hopes for signs of water, of life, even if long extinguished, and maybe for a place one day to extend the human habitat into space. With a new rover on the planet, all things suddenly seem possible. Tonight on Point, Mission to Mars and mankind's next giant leap. Did you get goosebumps like that NASA ground crew when Spirit touched down on Mars? What do you want from Mars? Do you see opportunity up there or a lot of dust? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin our journey to the Red Planet tonight in Pasadena, California, at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory Command Center. James Garvin is chief scientist for the Mars Exploration Project. Good evening and welcome, James Garvin.
Hey, thanks, Tom. We're just tickled pink, literally, or maybe red, to be back home on Mars.
Back home on Mars. That's great. Everything seems to have gone swimmingly so far. How good is the news at this point in the project?
Oh, it is absolutely stunning. I mean, it's so stunning, I think many of the people involved are speechless. Three and a half years ago, we had a dream to go to Mars and explore it the way people do with machines. And to think of the hard work all the women and men did to get us there, we're there, folks. I mean, we're going to be crawling around Mars, operating like many field explorers do here on Earth, only 100 million miles away.
So tick it off the pieces of this for us so far. What are the major things that have gone right?
Well, the first thing that went right was we picked a bold mission 3.5 years ago, which I'm proud of the whole, you know, community for doing that. Next, we worked really hard and built a really robust, adaptable system. This is something that can adapt to Mars, asking questions the way Mars is guiding us. This is first time ever. Then we managed to get it launched in record time last June when Spirit launched, even amidst Florida weather. That's always tricky in the summer. Mm-hmm. In any event, and then we took this long trip to Mars, testing the systems, meeting adversity on the way, little things we had to do. I'm just so proud of the team here at JPL that got us there, you know, with that dream.
And you came down onto the surface without the big busting up that seems to have been everyone's nightmare.
Well, that's true. In fact, what we learned is that we don't know as much about this wonderful Mars atmosphere that we thought. Just a few weeks before the mission, a regional dust storm brewed on one side of Mars, and its effect influenced, in fact, the way we passed through that atmosphere and that 6 minutes of terror that led to our landing. So where we are now, we're down, we're safe, we have power, we're charging up, waking up very soon, in fact, today, on Mars time, and we're talking to home straight from Mars, and through Mars Odyssey and Mars Global Surveyor.
It's exciting. We have so many questions. Let me put some to you here, James. To begin with, what can this machine do?
Well, what it can do is really three things. First, it can look around with vision that is better than mine. For the first time, we can look at Mars through 20/20 stereo vision, see how far away things are, see the shapes of rocks, soils, or whatever's there. So that's big.
So you're not moving blind.
No, we're not moving blind. Mm-hmm. You know, eyes wide open here, robot eyes, people on Earth. And next, we can actually read the clues in rocks the way geologists read them. Rocks kind of, you know, are like artifacts in archaeology. Mm-hmm. They're made up of bits of stuff. In this case, they're not pochards or other things.
Right.
They're little things called minerals. And, you know, as I like to tell kids out there, never met a rock that lied to me. So we're going to read the rocks first with a mineral mapping device known as a spectrometer. And we've never had one this close to the rocks on Mars in human history. So we're going to do that. Then, when we decide which ones are the most interesting, the ones that might hold the clues, the fingerprints, you know, the forensic clues to how water worked on Mars, we're going to drive up to them, grind away the grunge or whatever gunk is on the rocks, dust, whatever, and start looking inside the rock with hand lens, microscopic vision, you know, the, the way I do in the field when I'm out doing geology. Then read what's the rock made of. Actually doing what here on Earth field geologists would do back in the lab. We're bringing it with us to Mars, 100 million miles away. And finally, we're going to use another device that can tell us sort of where did the iron go? Iron is one of those little, you know, it's like a tracer. Well, it's sort of like the canary in the cave thing. I mean, if it went one way, it means water did this. If it went another way, did that. So
where did it go? But there's still surely a lot of iron up there. That's why Mars is red, isn't it?
Right. But it's the way iron was involved in the way the rocks look that matters. You know, it's not all red for one reason. And, you know, I have I had a red car, and it wasn't because it rusted. So we have to we're trying to be adaptable to what Mars throws at us. You know, we go to Mars, spend all this effort, human power, money, energy, time, taxpayers' dollars, which we're grateful to have. And then, you know, we want to go and ask the question and not let Mars throw a curveball at us. And so what we've done is build a system that will minimize the Mars tricked us again syndrome.
Right. This time you're ready for it. $800 million. You've got this one on the surface and another rover, Opportunity, to come down on the other side of the planet in a few months' time.
Opportunity is sitting about 3 weeks out. We're going to go through this great roller coaster ride of landing all again with this unbelievable team in just 3 weeks in another place just as interesting as the place we just landed.
Okay, so, tell us about the importance of vision. You said it's got better vision than you do. What's the significance for a scientist looking at Mars of having great vision?
Well, firstly, you know, rocks may look boring, but I see the field that we see here on Gusev Crater, like all the science team, as a forest of rocks. And, you know, forests are kind of cool here on Earth. So the vision allows us to see the trees for the forest. And we're going to look at the rocks, and each of them is a little artifact to the way Mother Nature made Mars the way it is in this place. And try to, you know, play detective. You know, it's kind of like Sherlock Holmes and Watson do Mars. We're going to do that. And you got to have good eyes to do that.
So in about a week's time, the rover that's within this big mechanism will come down off its 15-inch platform, get down onto the surface of Mars, and begin moving around. It can move, what is it, something like 125 feet a day? Do I have that right?
Roughly. It does depend on the terrain. This is a good place to drive. But, in fact, later in the mission, after we practice, we may be able to do better.
And it's going to go around. It's going to look all over the place. It's going to be looking at rocks. It's going to ultimately be scratching and grinding at rocks. It's going to send you back all that information. I'm sure from a scientist's point of view, that's a cornucopia. From a layman's point of view, what is it fundamentally about? Is this archaeology, looking at the past? What are the implications for the future? If we don't have just an abstract interest in the composition of Mars or has an historical interest that a scientist might have, is there a future-oriented piece to this investigation?
Absolutely. And let me just put it in context for you, try to make it, you know, explicable. We have a program of Mars exploration. We don't want to be fooled. Mars is a big place, you know. Land area the same as the continental landmass on Earth. We're looking for what you might imagine to be the Martian fossil record. And it took people on this planet hundreds of years to understand that we had one, what it meant, how it told us about the story of life, maybe how it, you know, impacted us. So we're trying to explore Mars to find places where it might have been really good to live on Mars in the past. We're looking for, you know, the ancient vacation spots. Today, Mars is pretty bleak and cold. So if you went there, you'd probably freeze to death, and it would be rather nasty. But so we're going to look to see, when was it clement? When was it hospitable?
And what does that tell you? What do you take from that knowledge?
Well, we take from that, you know, depending on how it was, if we knew that Mars harbored big lakes, and they sat there for millions of years, thousands of years, then those kind of places are real good places for life to spring forth. That's what happened in the early Earth.
So there may have been life there. Do we know whether or not there's water on Mars today?
We know Mars has a huge reservoir of frozen water in two polar caps and in the soils up at the higher latitudes.
And is there any question about whether there is or is not life? Are you sure that life is a past tense word, phrase for Mars?
No, we don't know. That's what we're asking. Mm-hmm. Because the real problem is, and Tom, I know this is, you know, elusive, problem is we don't know how life sort of got started here, and the record books of early Earth have been wiped clean. So we're kind of running in the dark, and we're saying, well, if we can find places that were warm and wet for a long time in the past on Mars, either recent past or really long-distant past, maybe those are the places where the stuff, the goodies, the missing pieces of the puzzle are going to be preserved. And we know right now that at least some of that preservation is likely in the rocks, as boring as they seem.
And those pieces of the puzzle, if let's say you could learn everything there was to know about the past of Mars, what does that tell us about the future of human interaction with Mars?
Well, I mean, first, it raises the question, if we learned that we weren't alone and that the past of Mars, you know, had the building blocks of life and they came together and maybe organized in a different way or got a start and then failed, Mars just wasn't good enough. It failed, didn't last. That could tell us about environmental limits of life on Earth. Secondly, it could tell us about how we got started. And that, again, that record's gone. Finally, by doing this kind of exploration, not just these rovers, but the whole program we have for this entire decade, we think we'll get to know the places on Mars where someday, if the choice is made, way above my pay grade, the place where people may want to go. And whether they go as first explorers or to solve a science problem, find the Martian fossils, find the Martian habitats, or whether they go as explorers to learn to live on another world is a question that one will have to ask in future years. But so I look at this as we're taking those critical baby steps, crawling out of that cradle, if you will, and starting to explore Mars the way people ultimately will. And I believe people have to go to Mars someday.
So the little robot Christopher Columbus is up there and looking very healthy and happy at the moment, and lots of delight in Pasadena today. James Garvin, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, I think, an old friend of yours. Andy Chaikin is joining us from Arlington, Vermont. He's a writer and author of several books, including A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts, and Space. Good evening and welcome, Andy Chaikin.
Tom, hi. It's great to be back, and it's great to be on with my buddy Jim. We go back a long way, and let me just start by saying how thrilled I am, Jim, at the success, and for you and all of the people who made this happen. It is so inspiring and such a relief, frankly, that everything has gone as well as it did.
Andy Chaikin, we hear Jim's thanks for that. Congratulations, and everybody feels it today. How long were the odds? I mean, there was a time when we began to think that, well, space just works like clockwork. And well, then, of course, we had problems on Mars. We had problems with Challenger. I mean, is it a 50-50 thing when a project like this goes up, or something else?
Well, I can't begin to give you the odds of what of this mission succeeding or failing. All I can tell you is that two-thirds of all the missions sent to Mars failed in the past. And if you look at just the ones that tried to land on Mars, the failure rate is even higher. I'm lucky enough to have participated in the first Mars landing as a student intern back when Jim and I were both in college.
This is Viking in 76?
Yes, and I was with the geologists. I was a geology student myself when the first images came down from the surface of Mars, and Viking almost made it look easy. You look back at Viking now and you realize what an incredible achievement it was. Pathfinder in 97, I was a reporter, seeing it from the other side of the glass, so to speak. And this time I was home with my wife in snowy Vermont watching it on the Internet. But I can tell you that when it works, it gives us all such a marvelous gift because I actually don't need to be at JPL to take part in this adventure. And anybody who has access to the Internet can see the images online.
They're right now at NASA.gov.
And if you think these images are good, wait till you see the ones from the very detailed cameras, which are going to be so good that they could be shown on an IMAX screen. And in fact, there's a fellow not far away from me in New Hampshire who made the Shackleton documentary for PBS, and he is producing a documentary for IMAX in 3D.
So we may all feel like we're sitting on Mars very soon. James Garvin, I know we just have you for another minute. If your wildest dreams come true, what are the most important insights you hope are taken away from this exploration?
Well, I Tom, and by the way, I just wanted to say hi to Andy, my old buddy. We were hallmates together and, you know, played hall hockey and suffered through the, you know, freshman year of calculus and everything at Brown.
That's
so, you know, threw rocks at each other, but it's a great tribute to be here with my friend Andy. Anyway, what are my wildest dreams? Well, look, I don't like to predict science, but if I were a betting Martian, I would say, one, I'd like to see in those rocks the record of water as a long-term element of that surface, that we had times when Mars was darn nice place to live. That's one. Number two, I would love to find some of these, you know, mineralogic building blocks of life,
yeah,
even ones that could be that. If we saw that from these rovers while we're crawling around on another world, that's going to train our thinking for everything we do. And the impact of that on what we do in this program to try to really get the answer for the people would be huge. And I wanted to add one other thing. I just saw my friend Rob Manning, head of our entry, descent, landing team here, and he reminded me that in his record, he's 2 for 2 in landing on Mars.
Right.
So
it's not easy. James Garvin, we've got to take a break. We're so glad you joined us tonight. Thank you very much, James Garvin, Chief Scientist, NASA's Mars Exploration Project. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Mars, the new Mars mission, and mankind's next giant leap in space. It's got everything to do with the red planet. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you scouring the new photographs of the red planet? What do you see up there? Do you see opportunity? Do you see a lot of red dust? What do you want from Mars? Is Martian archaeology enough? Are you ready to colonize? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We were just talking with James Garvin, Chief Scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Project. He joined us from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. We're joined tonight by Andy Chaikin. He's author of A Man on the Moon and Space. We're joined now from Tucson, Arizona, as well, by William Boynton, Professor of Planetary Sciences at the University of Arizona. He heads up the Gamma Ray Spectrometer on the Mars Odyssey Project that reached Mars in 2001 and continues to orbit around the planet. Good evening and welcome, Professor Boynton.
Good evening. I'm very pleased to be here with you.
We're delighted to have you. Your first thoughts on watching with the rest of us as we saw the first news of Spirit setting down on Mars.
Oh, it was fabulous. I was there watching. I wasn't out at JPL, but watching here in Tucson on closed circuit TV and going through the nail-biting moments when we're really expecting to get data back, and it wasn't coming, and it wasn't coming, and it seemed like an interminable amount of time. It really was only a few minutes, but then when the data finally did show up, it really, really made all the difference, and it was such a cheer when up here, just as it did out at the Jet Propulsion Lab.
And we know it's not easy. The British had a probe that landed, or we think landed, some days ago, but there's still been no word from that, right?
That's correct, and I myself have been involved with two Mars missions that failed: Mars Observer that blew up just days before arrival at Mars,
yeah,
and the Mars Polar Lander that crash-landed near the South Pole in 1999.
Now, you've had the orbiting Mars Odyssey in orbit around the planet since 2001 and with a gamma-ray spectrometer on board looking down from orbit. How much more detailed, how much better is the information you're anticipating from this, you know, worm-level view of Mars?
Well, it's actually very, very different types of information. What we get from orbit, whether it's the Odyssey mission or any other mission, is a big global context and kind of can see how all of the little aspects of Mars play together in the big picture. What they're going to be looking at down up close, where they actually have microscopes that can look up rocks and things like that,
mm-hmm,
is really looking at the small details. And it's kind of like in one case looking at the forest from a long distance away, and in another case, then you're actually looking right up at the bark and looking at the beetles in the bark and things like that.
And Andy Chaikin, can you describe for us how different this rover is from its predecessors, from the Viking and Pathfinder that landed on Mars years ago?
Sure. Viking, for starters, didn't move. It sat in one place, and it gave us our first look at the surface of Mars from the surface, and that was incredibly historic and incredibly valuable scientifically. It was not until Pathfinder landed and brought along its little companion, the Sojourner rover,
mm-hmm,
that we actually had the ability to move around from place to place. But Sojourner was a very limited craft. It was about the size of about a microwave oven or bigger than that. And these two rovers that are, one of them on Mars and the other one heading to Mars, are the size of a golf cart.
About 15 times that size, we read.
And much more complex. I mean, as Jim Garvin was saying, each of these rovers contains the instruments that you would need if you were a field geologist on Mars. They have actual chemical laboratories to analyze the composition of the rocks and the soil. They have microscopes, which for the very first time will give us a microscopic look at the Martian soil and the Martian rocks. They even have a tool on the end of their little robotic arm that can scrape away the coatings on rocks. You know, when a rock sits out on the surface,
it's going to be dust covered. They can dig down inside.
They can dig down inside and actually get at what the real stuff is inside the rock. So, I mean, it's a just from a technological point of view, never mind the science, it's an amazing project. And the science that it can do is much, much more sophisticated than anything we've had on Mars before.
Andy, reading up on Mars today, there's clearly been such a focus on this planet for the past decade and more. This is seen, as I understand it, as the next big step. I mean, there's talk again now about the moon and maybe even some kind of platform on the moon. But Mars is the next big destination. Why?
Well, Mars has always been the holy grail for anybody that believes in space exploration because it's always had a grip on our imaginations. It's the one planet that we've thought over the years we might find evidence of past life or even present life. And one of the reasons why the Spirit landing being successful is so important is because now NASA has a success under its belt after the failures of Mars Polar Lander and some of the others and the Columbia tragedy. NASA's getting back on the right footing again, and this is a backdrop to the expected White House announcement on space, which the noises I'm hearing are that it could happen sooner rather than later.
And this is the word that came out, last month, that Karl Rove may be advising President Bush to announce a big new space initiative as a kind of positive, forward-looking mission, something that might go to the moon and might even talk about Mars.
I hadn't heard about the Karl Rove link, but I could understand why he would want something positive. No, I think that the reports we heard last month were actually a very crude, clumsy leak about the announcement. And in fact, what I've been hearing, and I was part of a closed-door space policy workshop, mm-hmm. which included the NASA administrator about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
What I'm hearing is that it's not about a destination in particular. It is about giving the United States the capability to get back in the exploration business with robots and humans by sending them beyond Earth orbit. That could mean back to the moon. It could be to build giant arrays of telescopes in deep space. And then eventually, by building up these capabilities, building new spaceships, but doing it in a way that's within the existing budgetary framework, we can, within the next, let's say, 25 years, start planning to send people to Mars.
William Boynton, do you see that vision? Does it sound realistic to you?
Yes, definitely. I think it's really a very important thing for us to be doing, and I think going at it stepwise, as it sounds like the approach they're planning on taking based on the leaks I've heard, seems like quite a reasonable approach.
What's the point of going to Mars? What's the point of sending humans to Mars, let's say?
Well, scientifically, we can do an awful lot with robotic missions. There's no doubt about it. But when you send humans there, you're really doing something very, very different. It's really a challenge, and a lot of the reasons we're doing what we're doing is really because of the challenge to develop the technologies to really excite kids about pursuing high technology careers and so forth. And there's nothing that's going to excite kids more about getting into science and engineering than it would be to send humans to Mars.
And beyond the inspiration, in the 90s, we began to read about these ideas about sending artificial habitat directly to Mars, and you'd have a crew that would live off the land there, somehow grow greenhouse crops and tap subsurface groundwater, get manufacturing materials there, construct domes the size of shopping malls, and maybe even pull rocket fuel out of materials on Mars. Is that a fantasy, or is that possible here, William Boynton?
I would say at this point it's a fantasy, but a nice thing about doing things stepwise and doing it slowly is if it makes sense 50 years from now for things to evolve into that nature, then it will. And it's very hard to predict 50 years from now what's going to be driving society and what our goal is going to be and whether it makes sense. So I think now it's a fantasy, but it's not something that wouldn't be impossible for the future.
We're going to be hearing more about space exploration from the Bush White House in fairly short order, Andy Chaikin says. And, of course, we've already heard we are not going to be the only ones exploring in space. Many nations are looking at that, plus the EU, China looking at a manned space program. Now, we have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I'd like to turn to them. Theo's calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, Theo. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just, You know, in listening to all this, the daydreamer that I am thinking, listen, this would be great for us to go up there. But, you know, if we can do a quick review of what the Martian atmosphere is like, and, you know, I look at the pictures and they look fantastic. They look like you'd step down on the planet right now. But what's it really like there? And what would we have to do in order to land people there?
Great. William Boynton, can you speak to that?
Certainly. Mars' atmosphere is very thin. It's made up almost entirely of carbon dioxide. So it's not an atmosphere that we could breathe. We'd have to bring along our own oxygen supply. The temperatures are very cold there. Typically, they're running around, it's a very wide range, but an average temperature might be around minus 60 degrees. So it wouldn't be a pleasant place from that standpoint. But you could build a habitat where you have an airlock and have higher pressures and have an oxygen-rich environment and use solar heating to keep things warm. So it's not impossible, but it wouldn't be easy.
Do we know, are there the elements on Mars to produce oxygen there?
Oh, certainly. The rocks are all made with a substantial component of oxygen. We have found a lot of water on Mars. In fact, the Mars Odyssey mission that I'm involved with and my instrument has detected a lot of water beneath the surface in the polar regions. And, of course, oxygen is a major component of water, being the O part of H2O.
So you imagine that eventually humans could go up and sink a well, or I don't know what you describe it as, but tap that underground ice/water?
Certainly, and you set up solar panels and just use this process called electrolysis, where you run electricity into water and you generate hydrogen and oxygen from the water.
Theo, you've seen the pictures. It doesn't look like a vacation spot at this point. It's pretty bleak, but can you picture yourself, humans visiting, living on Mars?
It's fascinating, obviously, but I do wonder one other thing, which is, you know, what sort of consideration is given to humans sort of messing up the environment up there, you know?
Well, we can't put foot anywhere without having an impact on it. Andy Chaikin, is there already an environmental impact statement being prepared for Mars?
Well, by the time we get there, we will really have to have all that stuff figured out. As it is now, any space probe that goes to Mars, I believe, if the requirements have not changed, this has been in effect since before the Vikings, has to be sterilized. And that was one of the things that made Vikings so difficult, was they had to bake the electronics in an oven to sterilize it before it could even land.
So that they didn't introduce something that would mess up that Martian atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of trying to take the old Star Trek, screw up the planet you visit kind of approach.
Hard to sterilize human beings.
Well, that's right. And that's just one of many reasons why going to Mars is going to be a challenge. And I'd like to add to what Bill Boynton just said. Not only is it going to be difficult to make a home on Mars, but it's going to be difficult to survive the trip to Mars. When you consider the fact that it takes, with current technology, 6 to 9 months to get there, mm-hmm. and then you probably land on the surface and stay there for weeks or months or maybe even the better part of a year, and then you've got 6 to 9 months on the way home, you've got not only long-term exposure to weightlessness, which we know causes some very detrimental changes to the body, but also space radiation. And that is a huge problem. So when we talk about going to Mars, we're not talking about, gee, do we want to hike, Mount Katahdin next
right.
weekend? Let's rest up. We're talking about Everest. It's going to be a tough, tough job, and that's why we have to build up to it bit by bit.
Extremely challenging. Theo, thanks for your call. I want to turn to a guest right now who's got as much experience as anyone in exactly those terms of space travel. Joining us from Houston, Texas, is Alan Bean. He's a retired astronaut. He was lunar module pilot on the Apollo 12 mission, the second lunar landing in 1969, and spacecraft commander of Skylab Mission 2 in 1973. Alan Bean, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Tom. I just heard what Andy was saying, and he certainly describes it as a challenging mission, for sure.
Well, you've been to the moon. Can you imagine making the trip to Mars?
Well, certainly I can imagine it. I wish that I could actually do it. Of course, when we were doing it back in 1969, we thought that maybe in our lifetime people would be going to Mars, because we had the feeling then that the country would do the things that were possible for it to do, which is what we were doing at that moment.
A lot of momentum was behind you.
A lot of momentum, and we knew we had the technology to do it, and that we just needed the will, so we thought that would come right along. It didn't happen that way. However, when the national will does become apparent, then there will be people and ways to go do it.
Alan Bean, you've been right there on the moon. You've seen another fairly thrilling and bleak landscape in outer space. Do you think that humans will eventually have the appetite to live for extended periods on celestial bodies like these?
I do, but I don't think we'll leave them like we find them. You know, human beings have certain likes and dislikes. So if they showed up on this dried lake bed, hopefully, mm-hmm. someday, they're going to find a way to enclose it so that they can live there, and then they're going to plant green plants and trees, and, you know, they're going to do things to make it familiar to Earth creatures, and they'll find that beauty, and then they'll also find the beauty that's there, and they'll like that too. But human beings will adapt themselves, and they will also make the environment adapt.
It won't remain a space wilderness. William Boynton, we've even heard this phrase, terraforming. I guess the idea of a kind of planetary scale manipulation of environments to make Mars more like Earth. Is that wild or what?
I think it's wild. It again may not be entirely impossible, but we're a long, long way away from that. And at this point, I think it's not likely any of us, or probably even the listeners you may have out there, would live long enough to see that, would be my guess.
Well, that sounds like a fairly colossal, fairly long-term project, if it ever could happen at all. Right. Alan Bean, do you see astronauts in training today who are being prepared for a project like a trip to Mars?
No, I hope not. They'd be wasting their money right now. We'd be, hopefully, we are getting together the technology, you know, on a low effort basis. Don't want to spend too much money on it, because we want to spend money on things that we actually can do or will be charged to do, like the space station, getting the shuttle ready. But we do have a number of people at NASA and other parts of the world that are thinking about these advanced missions and also understand what it would take to do those missions. But you don't have to keep working on something. Let's say you've got a trip to California. You don't have to work on it every day to come up with a good plan. Maybe you revisit it once a year.
Right.
So that's kind of the way it is. You need to spend most of your effort and time on things that you actually have been charged by the Congress and the President to do.
And very quickly, do you think a return to the moon will be a step toward advancing on Mars?
Well, I hear a number of people that are quite smart talking that way. I personally don't see it that way. I see it more as the next big step will be actually to go to Mars, and we'll go it not from a space station, but go right from Earth, just as we did the moon.
Mars Direct. Buckle up, folks. We're on our way. Alan Bean, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
No, thank you very much.
Alan Bean joined us from Houston, Texas. He was lunar module pilot on the Apollo 12 mission, man's second lunar landing in 1969. We're talking tonight about Mars, the new Mars mission, and mankind's next giant leap in space. You can join the conversation. Is getting back to the moon, getting to Mars, important to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Mars, the new Mars mission, and mankind's next giant leap in space. It's all about Mars right now. Everyone's paying very close attention at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory Command Center in Pasadena, California. And around the world, you can join our conversation tonight. Is getting astronauts back to the moon, getting them to Mars, important to you, or does it look like a waste of money? Would it change your mind if you thought China might land there first? Do you want to see men and women on Mars, or are robots enough? And is Mars an answer to human problems on Earth? Is it a distraction? Is it inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Andrew Chaikin, joins us from Arlington, Vermont. He's author of A Man on the Moon and Space. And from Tucson, Arizona, William Boynton is with us. He's professor of planetary sciences at the University of Arizona and heads up the Gamma Ray Spectrometer on the Mars Odyssey. It's been orbiting Mars since 2001. I'm going to welcome you into the conversation as well. Lad is on the line. Hi, Lad. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
Fantastic program tonight.
Great.
What's
on your mind, Lad?
You can direct my question to, I guess, both of your guests would be great candidates to answer this question.
Yeah.
When we're up there evaluating the soil or the rocks that you've been talking about earlier in the program,
yeah,
how do you know that these are truly Martian rocks, that they haven't landed there from,
it's not just parts of an asteroid that blasted in.
Right. Mars has been up there a long time, traveling through the universe or through the, let's put it this way, through the solar system.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff floating around up there.
So how do you know it's indigenous? How do you know it's really Martian?
That's right.
Okay, let us pick it up. Lad, thanks for your call. William Boynton, may I put that to you?
Sure, I'd be glad to answer that. In fact, there's a tiny, tiny, tiny chance that a little pieces of some of the rocks could be from elsewhere, because asteroids do crash into the Earth, do crash into Mars and the Moon, and they leave, in case of Earth, meteorites behind. But we know from studying rocks on the Earth and the Moon that it's a very, very rare event. So there may be a chance in a million, or maybe it's even more like a chance in 100 million, that one of those rocks might be a meteorite that actually landed on Mars from elsewhere. But the odds are that it's formed there and has been there all its life.
And Andy Chaikin, there's a lot of excitement that we heard from Pasadena today about a crater near the spot where Spirit came down in Gusev Crater, but a smaller depression, 50 feet away or so, that they're anxious, it seems, to perhaps go and explore. Why?
Right. This is the this is the feature that they're calling Sleepy Hollow.
Right.
And basically, when you do geology on the surface of another planet that has craters on it, you want to use those craters like excavations.
Mm-hmm.
Craters dig into the surface and they blast out pieces of whatever is there. So by getting at the rocks that were thrown out of the crater, which would be located near the rim of the crater, the largest ones, mm-hmm, would, you can actually get a sample of the subsurface material. And so the geologists are very interested in seeing as many different parts of the surface as they can. If, for example, the surface is covered by a thick layer of dust, then these craters may actually excavate the bedrock that's underneath and let us get a window into what that's all about.
So you can, without a bulldozer, you get to dig deeper. William Boynton, there was discussion today of kind of dust devils, a little wind spirals on Mars having cleaned away dust from some of the surfaces around the rover's landing site. Is there wind on Mars? I guess there is.
Yes, there definitely are. That's one of the interesting things about Mars, is it not only has an atmosphere, it has winds and clouds and weather even, much like the Earth does. So it's that's one of the beauties that makes it really an attractive place to study when you're trying to look at all the various processes that go on there.
When you say clouds and weather, that suggests to a layman's ear atmospheric water. Is that what you mean?
That's correct. It's a very, very tiny amount of water in the atmosphere. I live in Tucson, which is the desert, and we have very dry climate here. Mars is much, much drier, but it's also much colder, and so we can get conditions where you actually get very, very thin, wispy clouds that will form in the atmosphere, and sometimes we get frost on the surface, and in the winter times, mm-hmm, as perhaps many of your listeners are aware, we actually get a very thick CO2 frost that forms in the winter poles on Mars.
And we asked James Garvin earlier, but let me put it to you as well. Do you at this point have any openness to the idea that there could still be some form of life somewhere on or within Mars, or is that off the table?
No, I don't think it's off the table at all. I think it's entirely possible that if we dig beneath the surface, we might find some life forms that have adapted to very severe conditions. It's hard to put the odds on that, but that's why we're going back to Mars to look for these things. There's certainly some very strange life forms in the bottom of the oceans that live in environments we never could have imagined life ever could have lived at before.
So when you say that, are you imagining, what's the picture that comes to mind? Is this a tiny, cell-sized life form or something more developed, or you have no idea?
We really don't know, but a cell-sized would be the most likely as being the simplest form that things maybe could still have survived at. It's probably a long shot in any event, and just to know that life may one time in the past have been present would be pretty remarkable in its own right.
It really would, but still it is interesting sitting here tonight in 2004 with a rover on Mars with a scientist who knows well saying, well, there still could be something living on that planet.
Tom, can I throw in a comment about that? I would be as excited as anybody else if we found conclusive evidence that there was life on Mars or is life on Mars, but I would like to say also that even if we don't find evidence of life on Mars, it's still a fantastically interesting place. And part of what we're seeing, if you can just kind of sit back and watch this process unfold, we are learning things that no one has ever known before. And every time we've studied Mars in greater detail, we've had to rewrite the books. And I think what is happening right now with this new landing on Mars is we're seeing a new chapter in our gaining awareness of how the solar system came to be and how it works. And that's going to tell us about our own planet as well as Mars. So it's a fantastic intellectual adventure. It's a shared experience of discovery on the most exciting scale.
No question. And you heard Alan Bean saying, where humans go, humans do change things. That's just the way humans are. Can you imagine, let me, a specific question there, can you imagine humans introducing life to Mars?
Well, we had a question before about meteorites on the surface of Mars. We ought to say that meteorites and rocks seem to be flung back and forth between Mars and Earth and all of the other planets. That's just what happens when large impacts occur. And in fact, we've found meteorites on Earth that we know came from Mars. Who's to say that life didn't begin on Mars and then by means of an impact was transmitted to Earth? That's another theory.
So really, if it can travel on a rock, it can. When you start thinking about human...
We're just beginning to...
anything's possible there with that kind of interchange.
Yeah, we're just beginning to grasp what that means. And now, as far as human contaminating Mars, I do feel that that's something we're going to have to think very carefully about. But fortunately, we've got a long time before we send anybody to the surface of Mars to figure that stuff out.
Sure we do. Marx is on the line. Hi, Marx. You're on the air.
Yes. My question, as somebody... we had said earlier, Mars is the next big thing in space exploration, and it seems almost an unquestioned assumption. I think it's more of a mystical assumption rather than rational, because as far as finding life, I think Europa has Jupiter's moon, has potential for life now as opposed to fossil. Mm-hmm. And as for terms of colonization and mining, there are near-Earth asteroids which are easier to reach than the moon, let alone Mars.
So you're saying why Mars when you've got maybe a better chance at the Jupiter's moon, Europa, or if you're looking for minerals in space, look to the asteroids. William Boynton, what's your response?
Yes, that's actually a good point. Let's talk about Europa first. There have been some suggestions that deep beneath the surface, Europa may currently have liquid water, and perhaps life is still swimming around in there in some form or another. The difficulty with going to Europa is that it is very hard to get to. You have to contend with the gravity field of Jupiter, the incredible intense radiation belt that's around Jupiter, and it really is a very, very tough job to get there. And then once you get there, you may have to sink a drill hole down a kilometer deep to get there. So
inaccessible and a big challenge. What about asteroids?
Asteroids, we've already visited one. The near Shoemaker mission landed on the asteroid Eros. They're actually very interesting in some ways because they're like the most primitive building blocks of the solar system. But what really makes Mars interesting, quite apart from the life question, and Angie touched on this himself, is it's just a very diverse planet with such a rich range of possibilities of things that are going on. I mentioned earlier the atmosphere, the weather, the clouds. You mentioned dust devils. There's volcanoes.
But Marx's suggestion is, if we're just going to see these things in fossils, that this is a more mystical than practical mission.
I think he's got a point. And not that it's not practical, not that it won't have enormous benefits, but that I agree that Mars has a kind of hold on our imaginations that asteroids don't, and that many of the other places in the solar system don't. That doesn't mean that those other places are not important targets, and in fact, who knows, we may end up sending humans to visit an asteroid before we send them to Mars, simply because it is easier. But I think that the human imagination has been stirred by Mars in a way that is, you know, we just won't let it quit. We won't be satisfied until we see humans and hear human voices coming from the surface of Mars.
And that appears to be the direction, at least a big small step in the last couple of days. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Am I the John you're talking to?
Yes,
right now?
I believe you are.
Oh, good. Well, I'm delighted to participate in this program. I've been a big fan of the space program for a long, long time. In fact, in over the last 10 years or so, I've been very disappointed at the progress we've made. I was a spectator at the first moon landing, and if someone had told me 30 years ago that in the year 2004 we would not have put a human on Mars or done something more spectacular.
It is amazing when you think back to all the energy of that time, and we heard Alan Bean, the astronaut, saying the same thing earlier, John. That's right.
It's, if people approach this sort of exploration, you know, from the standpoint of we can't spend a lot of money on this because we have problems at home and there are problems of poverty around the world and stuff like that, then we'll never do any exploration. So, I think it's great for the human spirit, and I've been a fan of Dr. Boynton's for many years. As a matter of fact, I'm delighted to say he's a good friend of mine.
Oh, well, that's great. John, say hi to William. William, say hi to John.
Is this John Wilson?
Is this Boynton?
How you doing?
I guess we've made a connection far from Mars. John, thanks for your support and for your call. I guess to the last question of cost, it was George Bush's father, Andy Chaikin, on the 20th anniversary of the first human moon landing in July of 1989, who issued a call for sustained commitment to human exploration of the solar system, even with the notion of Mars, of a Martian destination in there. NASA came back with a $400 billion plan, and that was the last we heard of it. Will these high, excited moments also sink under the cost of real deep exploration when those costs come fully to light?
I don't think so, and I think NASA has learned a lesson. What happened back in 1989 with Bush Sr. was that somebody convinced the White House that you could go back to 1961, that all you needed was a presidential pronouncement that we should go explore space in a big sustained program and that everything would take care of itself. Well, that was horribly misguided, and in fact, the NASA administrator spent 2 hours talking to Bush Sr. about that, and basically what the former president said was, I got set up, we all got set up.
But there's a $500 billion deficit now. Is there the money there to do more?
Well, I think that there is the money to keep funding NASA at its current level, and what I'm hearing is that NASA is working very, very hard and using all the brain power it can to figure out how to do a bold program of exploration within the budget it has.
Well, they've got a big success to take to the White House just in these last few days. Andy Chaikin, thank you very much for spending the time with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Great to have you. And William Boynton in Tucson, Arizona, thanks so much for coming on.
I'm very happy to do it. Thank you.
Andy Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon, William Boynton, professor of planetary sciences at the University of Arizona. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.